Good afternoon, everyone. So nice to see you. Nice to see some new faces and old faces. So the title of the talk is Getting Back on the Horse. Yesterday, 8 years ago, I found myself lying on the pavement of Bellmead Boulevard at 6 in the morning. I had been out biking that morning, and it's dark at 6 in the morning right now, and I was coming down a hill, and I couldn't see in the dark, but there was this oil spill. And so as I hit that oil spill, my bike and I just went airborne. And I came down where the ball of the humerus comes into the shoulder socket. And so I was lying there in the dark, and there's this car that's bearing down on me. And I thought, really, I need to get out of the middle of the road. And so I dragged myself off to the side of the road, and I thought, you know, I think I maybe have broken my collarbone, or maybe I've, got my shoulder out of joint. And the car stopped, and this man in scrubs, you know, surgical scrubs, got out of the car, and he took one look at me. He said, "Do you need to go to the hospital?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I do." And so we were driving to the hospital, and I said, "Do you think you could call my wife and let her know that we're going to the hospital?" And so he said, "Sure." And so he said, "What's her name?" And I said, "It's Kathy." And so he dials her up and he says, "Kathy, your husband's been in an accident." Period. And then he says, he's okay. He's going to the emergency room. And so maybe you could meet us there. So the way I came across this memory, while I was digging through this medical file, and I came across this souvenir in the back. You can't see this, but I have a titanium plate with 7 screws in my humerus now. And this is my souvenir from that day. It was about a year rehabilitation, and I knew that I had come out of the rehabilitation. I was in a month-long silent retreat at the Forest Refuge in Western Massachusetts. And I was doing some yoga. And up until that time, I had been able to get about that high with my arm. But I was doing some yoga, and somehow I just went through that last piece of constriction, and I was able to, you know, get all the way up. And as it made this really loud crack, I thought, this is either really good or really bad. So it was really good. So for some reason this year, I have been having the thought about getting back on the bike. You would think, you know, really, why? I mean, after all that, why? But I thought, you know, I'd really like to get back on the bike. And so I went to this bike store, and I walked in, and the owner of the bike store had his arm in a sling. And I said to him, "Let me guess." And so we shared our orthopedic adventures, and that was kind of funny. But I got this bike, and I've been riding this bike, and it's just done wonders for my mental health. I just love doing this. But getting back on the bike has had an unintended consequence. And this is what I want to talk about this morning. It has impacted my work life. So I have this rhythm in the morning of exercising and doing a little Qigong and doing this little celebration of communion and eat and, you know, read a little Thomas Merton and the Buddha and drink my tea and get showered and go to work. And I just noticed that I was rushing through all that. And you know, it just seemed like kind of counterproductive to be rushing through my spiritual practice. And it felt actually kind of sacrilegious. So I thought, well, what can I do about this? And I thought, well, you know, you don't actually have to see your first client at 8 o'clock the way you've been doing for the last 40 some odd years. You could actually start your day at 9 o'clock. And this just felt like, you know, an insult against nature. You know, it was just something that it was very hard to consider. But I kept considering it, and so I started doing that. I told my 8 o'clock clients we were going to have to find another time because I was going to start working at 9 o'clock. I asked myself why now, and I thought, well, maybe it's because I've just paid my last tuition check for my son's law school. You know, maybe that's what let me off the hook. But I really don't think that was it. I think what's been driving me all along is addiction. And it's just addiction to the way I've always worked. You know, like, how am I going to justify myself if I'm not working at 8 o'clock? You know, in Christian parlance, this goes under works righteousness. You know? Like you're going to save yourself by your work, whatever it is. This addiction, like all addictions, is just insidious. It's often operating, you know, sort of like the man behind the curtain. It's just sort of operating there in the background. You don't even know it's doing it until something causes you to take a little bit deeper look. And you say, oh my gosh, look at what has been running the show all this time. When I was teaching pastoral care at the Divinity School, one of the books that I really loved teaching out of was this little book by Ram Dass called How Can I Help? And it's subtitled Stories and Reflections on Service. And I started looking through this book and I got major sidetracked from writing this talk. I just love this book. If you're in this world of service, I commend it to you if you don't already have it. I won't read anything out of it. There are really so many good things, it's just impossible to choose. So many good things. So I want to think with you about Sabbath. You know, that commandment to remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. And there's sort of daily Sabbath. And, you know, what I have in these morning practices, and now that I've got this space between 6 and 9, there is just not this pressure. There is actually some leisure. Sabbath has something to do with leisure. There's this leisure to actually sink into not only the bike ride, but the Qigong afterwards and not rush through any of that. Not rush through the meditation. Rushing through communion? Are you kidding me? Oh, really? And not rushing through the meal. I have such strong rushing conditioning. I don't know whether that's a part of your life or not. You know, maybe you're more on the relaxed end of the scale. That just is not my karma. You know, I'm more on the squeezing end of the scale, you know, like see how many things we can squeeze into this time slot. Jon Kabat-Zinn once said that really all of our problems are about time. They're around, I don't have enough time, or I've got too much time, or I find myself ruminating about the past, really living in the past, or I'm worrying about the future. And this sweet spot of mindfulness, this sweet spot of flow, if you're an athlete, a dancer, a Tai Chi practitioner, the key is relaxed, embodied awareness. And when we have the screws of time pressure bearing down on us, it's just really, even with the best intention, I'm going to meditate. If you're meditating in that energy field, it's not likely to be very fruitful. It's just one more thing you're kind of checking off your list. Oh, I did my meditation today. Have you had that experience? You know, so some daily C.S. Lewis called them inns of refreshment. Like that phrase. Some daily inns of refreshment. What are your inns of refreshment? You know, it doesn't have to be formal mindfulness practice. But, you know, do you have daily inns of refreshment? My rabbi friend Rami Shapiro talks about observing the Sabbath, and he said, you know, he really doesn't go to synagogue very much anymore. He says, it's just not speaking to him very much, which I think is just a remarkably wonderful statement from a rabbi. And but he says that one thing he really does faithfully is step away from electronic media on the Sabbath. He just shuts it down. He tells a great story about when he was studying with his Rebbe, Reb Zalman Shachter Shalomi, really one of the great rabbinic figures of the last century. Rami was just carrying a bunch of books around on the Sabbath. You know, Rami's just hungry for knowledge. And he's carrying a bunch of books around. And Reb Zalman just knocks these books out of his hand. And Rami says, Reb Zalman, what's up with this? And Reb Zalman looks at him and says, Rami, no carrying on the Sabbath. He knew that what Rami needed to do, somebody else would have been fine for them to be carrying books. But what Rami needed to do was not be carrying this quest for knowledge. He needed a break from that. What is it that you need a break from? In the designated time each week, when Kathy was still living, we would pretty much try to make monthly trips to Sewanee to see her mom and her sisters. And there was something about driving up the mountain to Sewanee. I could just feel my blood pressure coming down. It was just so great to be walking in the woods. Each month we could pretty much, you know, count on doing that. And then twice a year we would go on at least a week-long retreat out to Spirit Rock Meditation Center, which was our spiritual home together. And I talked about this last week, about just how powerful it was for me to be back on that land where we had shared such depth of practice. Here's a little something from Thomas Merton. He's writing about Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi recognized, as no other world leader of our time has done, the necessity to be free from the pressures, the exorbitant and tyrannical demands of a society that is violent Because it's essentially greedy, grasping, and cruel. Therefore, he fasted, observed days of silence, lived frequently in retreat, knew the value of solitude, as well as of the totally generous expenditure of his time and energy in listening to others and communicating with them. He recognized the impossibility of being a peaceful and nonviolent man if one submits passively to the insatiable requirements of a society maddened by overstimulation and obsessed with the demons of noise, voyeurism, and speed. Merton's writing 50 years ago. By the way, did you happen to see the article? It's one of the most emailed articles in the New York Times today about anxiety in adolescence and the incredible spike in anxiety in the adolescent population. And it correlates exactly with the rise of social media. This is, I found myself weeping reading this article. This seems so familiar to me. Not the social media part, but just the pressure to perform in adolescence. Back to Merton. Gandhi believed that the central problem of our time was the acceptance or the rejection of a basic law of love and truth which had been made known to the world in traditional religions and clearly for Gandhi by Jesus Christ. Gandhi himself expressly and very clearly declared himself an adherent of this one law. His whole life, his political action, finally, even his death, were nothing but a witness to this commitment. If love is not the law of our being, the whole of my argument falls to pieces. If love is not the law of our being, the whole of my argument falls to pieces. And I really kind of went back and forth in my mind about whether I wanted to read this particular passage to you because of the rhetorical overemphasis of the word love in the Christian tradition. That word just drops so easily in liturgical settings, and we can hear it as an ought, you know. And if we're being loving, doing loving, feeling loving, then we're kind of on the right track. And if we're not doing and being and feeling loving, then somehow we're really that there's something wrong with us. Increasingly, what's important to me is not some moral imperative, but some way of actually accessing the energetic field of love. That's what Buddhists are talking about in the practice of loving kindness. You know, when we recite the loving kindness phrases, there are the phrases, you know, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be at peace. You know, we say those phrases and kind of rock into that, let ourselves be cradled by the rhythm of those phrases and the breathing. And then there's the actual feeling, you know, just the heart feeling of loving kindness. It's tenderness. And then there's this energetic field. And it's part of why I wanted to invite us at the end of the meditation tonight just to drop into that space of stillness. Because that relaxed, embodied awareness is the portal into this space of what Gandhi is calling love. There are other portals into this field of love, and one of those portals is wilderness. I've been corresponding with my old kayaking partner Kurt Holting, and we have decided to do another wilderness kayaking retreat in Southeast Alaska this summer. We're going to do this retreat from July 18th through 24th. So what follows is a shameless commercial for this retreat. There are only 12 slots in this retreat, two people in six boats. You know, as they say on the TV commercials, you know, supplies are limited, call now. But this really is a wonderful retreat. One, because just being in the great space of the Tongass National Wilderness, which is the largest preserved wilderness area in the United States. My friend Rob up there in the balcony has been on this trip with me. It's big medicine. It's really big medicine to be out there in the stillness of Alaska. And when you're paddling, there's a rhythm to each stroke, but there's a rhythm between paddling and resting. You just can't keep paddling for 4 or 5 hours. The body can't do that. So there has to be this oscillation of rest and recovery, of paddling and sometimes hard paddling, you know. Or sometimes leisurely paddling. And then these periods of just resting. And the boats are just floating with the tide. And sometimes, you know, these seals will come up with their black heads, like black Labradors, you know, looking out of the water. Or you'll see an eagle just swoop down and pick a salmon up with its talons and fly off. These are priceless experiences. Wilderness is a gate into this different kind of consciousness. That's what we're talking about here. Somebody once said, this is a German theologian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he said that remembering the Sabbath is not commandment, it's permission. Like permission. Some of us are old enough to remember blue laws, you know, when things weren't open on Sunday at all, or certainly not Sunday morning, and now, you know, there's travel soccer on Sunday morning. You know, it's a whole different world. So the question is, how do we preserve, how do we choose? And, you know, for you, it may be your trip to England. That may be where you find Sabbath. But setting aside these places where we can be refreshed. Come out of the squeeze of performance. When I was on this retreat last week, teaching alongside Philip Moffitt was a wonderful teacher with whom I had not studied before. Her name was Dana De Palma. And one of the things I loved about Dana's teaching was she really embodied the practice. I mean, just to be in her energy field was to be in this Sabbath space. And this language that I've been using with you since coming back from the retreat of resting down, resting on earth, letting the earth supporting the church and the floor, the wood of the floor supporting our bodies. This resting down is her language, and resting back into the breath. You know, this mindfulness practice, and this is, I think, what distinguishes it from, say, you know, your standard Christian or Jewish practice, with which there's just not a lot of emphasis on the body. Mindfulness practice invites embodied awareness. If it's not embodied, it's not mindfulness. So, what we're doing is relaxing into the felt sense of being held, relaxing into the felt sense of the breathing. So often with our experience, we're just kind of hovering. We're thinking about it, you know? We're hovering, but we're not really resting in the embodied experience. When you let your attention go into your hands, and you tune into these tingles, these sparkles in the hands, going into a different level of consciousness. I was working with a client, and she said, you know, when I'm not working and I'm not drinking, I'm just so aware of this terrible loneliness. And if you knew this person socially, you would not imagine that she is terribly lonely. She's really quite a gregarious person and fun to be with. But she says when she's not working and she's not drinking, and she realizes that what's here is this terrible loneliness. So this is an opportunity for us to work with the physical body and the vital body, this sense of vitality in the body, aliveness in the body, and then with the emotional body. And so we can ask, we can be curious and say, well, what's the felt sense of terrible loneliness? You know, we can just kind of sweep attention through the body or whatever. You know, whatever your issue is, it may not be terrible loneliness. You know, what's the felt sense of terrible loneliness? Not the story of how she got there, how it got to be that way in her life, which is an important story. But to actually experience this as an embodied experience. The trap here, the danger is that with strong emotional experiences, they're like eddies. And if you're kayaking out on the Harpeth River and you come across an eddy, your boat can really get sucked into the eddy. And it's a dangerous situation. It's the same thing with strong emotions. If we get close to those and we physically let ourselves experience them, we can, if they're really powerful, we can get sucked into grief. I certainly did. We can get sucked into fill in the blank. So what we have to learn to do is to pendulate, to move in and out of the safety of the physical body and the sensations of being held and being supported. And then being willing to go back into that felt sense of that terrible loneliness. Stay there for a while. This is not an endurance contest, and pendulate back into the physical body and the vital body. My teacher Philip says, and I think he's really on to something here, he says he thinks that one of the reasons that a lot of emotions don't just process on through our bodies is that we're trying to think through them, and they're really just stuck as... whether physical trauma or constriction, like the constriction here, we need to get into some kind of, I'm going to use this with air quotes, some yoga of consciousness. And that's what this pendulating between here's a feeling, here's a strong feeling, and here's its signature in the body, and then back to this physical experience of being held. It may be that you were fortunate enough in growing up to have people who could hold you well physically and who could hold you well emotionally, or maybe not so much. I think that a lot of people come to mindfulness practice as a corrective emotional experience, aka reparenting. And the foundation of this whole reparenting is the physical experience of being supported. So I love the way my colleague Paloma always begins her meditation. She always begins them with this dropping into this sense of being supported. And when I heard her teaching like that, I thought, oh, that's really good. But now I get it at a deeper level about why that's so important. I knew it felt good, but now I realize, oh, that's the foundation so that you can actually have the structure to be able to go in and work with the emotional challenges that we have. Dana used a phrase that really stuck with me. I'd never heard it before. The phrase is sweet ego. I'd never heard the adjective sweet tied to the ego. And what she's getting at here is like, look at this suffering ego, this suffering ordinary personality walking around consciousness. How pressured it is, how beleaguered it is, how striving it is, how trying to protect itself it is. I mean, that's its job, you know, is protection. And when we notice these energies happening in the ego, we're not trying to kill the ego, crush the ego, extirpate the ego. You know, we're not trying to get rid of the false self, to use that language from centering prayer. Actually, what we're doing is saying, oh, sweetheart. Oh, sweet ego. I see your suffering. So think of some way, perhaps, in which you either pressure yourself, as I was doing with my morning practice, or you are pressured through some, you know, external requirements. You know? You really aren't doing this to yourself. I mean, it really is, it's out there. It's, you know, it's pressuring you. So close your eyes for a minute. And just say to yourself, may I be free of this suffering. And just repeating that on the out-breath, may I be free of this pressure. May I be free of this perfectionism. May I be free of this burden of secrecy. Let's do that for a minute. And then think of someone you really care for, someone that you love. And you have some sense of what they carry. And just say, may you be free of your suffering. And do that for a minute. And noticing what happens in your heart as you do this. And we could do this for all beings. This practice, you can open your eyes if you like. This practice is one taught by my teacher, Guy Armstrong. And it's such a simple practice. May I be free of my suffering. May you be free, liberated from your suffering. Isn't this how the heart softens when we send those wishes to each other? So, one last story. I was working with a client, and she was talking about her spiritual practice, her own Sabbaths, and of going to Mass. And as a child, she had grown up going to daily Mass as part of her Catholic school ritual and just part of her family ritual. And she said that, quite honestly, you know, just going to Mass wasn't doing it for her anymore. And she had heard me talk about this, you know, little daily communion service that I do. I said to her, why don't you do it yourself? And she looked at me like, I'm not a priest. I'm not a man. You know, that's the way they do it in the Catholic Church. You know? There was a rule in medieval times that you had to have all 10 digits intact or you couldn't celebrate the Mass. You had to be without blemish. What a piece of insanity. So she was visibly moved at this invitation. She said, I've never thought of that. So she said, I'll try it. And so she wrote me back and she said, this was incredibly emotional. It was so healing. And it was so intimate. The church doesn't own communion. I can say this now because I'm retired. You know? It's kind of like Bob Corker, you know. So I was talking about, you know, the joy of getting back on the horse, getting back on the bike. But one of my favorite lines, and I've heard me say this before, is when the horse is dead, get off. You know, so, you know, if you're spiritual, Jack Kornfield's really great about this. He says, you know, things work for a while and then they don't. So, like, if your spiritual practice isn't working for you, like, go do something else. Go swimming. You know, go do something else. Do what works. Do what feeds you. So let's sit for a moment. So let's think about people outside this room and outside the circle of those we know and love. Let's think about strangers. People in California made homeless by the wildfires. Immigrants. And that's people who are vulnerable. I talked with someone today who had family members who have been made refugees by the fires. This is personal. See who comes to mind. It may be someone in prison or someone who's sick. And just say to them from your heart space, from this energetic field of compassion, may you be free from your suffering. And just do that for a minute. May you be free from suffering. May you find rest for your soul. And difficult people are just like us. They have a body and they have luminous consciousness. And we can say to our difficult person, may you be free from your suffering. May you find rest for your soul. And then finally, we do this for all beings. May all beings be free from suffering. May we find rest for our souls. We dedicate the merit of our shared practice this evening to the welfare of all beings, to the arising of rest and peace and compassion, and to the ending of suffering. So, Paloma Cain and I will be at St. Mary's Suwannee, October 20th through 22nd, leading our retreat of mindfulness on the mountain. If you want to find rest for your soul, come join us at that retreat. You can access it through the St. Mary's Suwannee website or through our One River Wisdom Nashville website as well. That Sunday at 1 o'clock, Sunday the 22nd, we'll be dedicating the Memorial Garden in Kathy's honor there at St. Mary's. So It's just going to be a really short little 15 or 20 minute dedication and a reception. So, you know, short little thing, but just know you're all welcome. So thank you for your kind attention, for your generosity as always, and have a great week and see you next week.